Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We know Thomas Jefferson as a great thinker, as a powerful writer, as a philosopher, inventor, farmer, as almost everything. But John Meacham, the Pulitzer Prize winner and the author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, puts another light on Jefferson as an astute political operative. And John Meacham, thanks for agreeing to talk to some of your friends here in Chapel Hill about your still new book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power.
I'm delighted. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's, you know, the question that anytime there's a new book about any of the great people in our history, folks say, why do we need another one? And I thought of that as I looked at
about I know you have
25 pages of small type, the list of books that you've got to sort of be familiar with before you can set out writing. What is it about the other biographies of Jefferson that you felt missed a little bit and needed another book about Jefferson?
Well, it's less about missing something and more about wanting to have your say. Jefferson is kind of the Everest of biography. You know, you want to climb it because it's there. I do think that in recent years, let's call it a quarter century, there's two things have happened in the historiography of in the popular historiography, I should say, of Jefferson. One is, understandably, with the rise of studies about slavery, the more we know about race in the early republic, Jefferson has not come out very well, understandably and justifiably. He was an unrepentant, ultimately, a slave owner, conflicted, but he still kept his slaves and perpetuated the institution. And so that view, as well as the controversy, and then I think the ultimate settling of the controversy about Sally Hemings, created a prevailing image in many people's minds of Jefferson as this figure who was seen mostly, if not exclusively, in relationship to slavery. So that's one part of what's happened in recent years. The other is that he's sort of been taken at his word in terms of wanting to be seen as a philosophical figure, as a man of the mountain, who went to Monticello and thought big thoughts and was more French than British in his outlook, all of that. I don't think either of those caricatures fully captures him. And there's some reductionism here, I admit. But I do think those are two of the prevailing views, that Jefferson was either an out-of-touch, dreamy philosopher or a hopeless, irredeemable slave owner. If you ask most people, I think that's what they would have said about him. What I wanted to do was try to figure out what he had actually done all day, which is a good way to begin any biographical project. And, you know, President Kennedy once said that the key to any biography is answering the question, what was he like? And what he was like was a politician. He was a man who, for 40 years, from 1769 in his first election to the Virginia House of Burgesses until 1809 when he left Washington after two terms as president, he was more or less constantly in public office. And if he wasn't, he was thinking about it. And so that's a huge part of his life. And I think that many of his hypocrisies, many of his contradictions, many of the more enigmatic elements of his character become explicable when you look at him through a political lens. Mm-hmm. Because politicians do not thrive and are not usually rewarded for consistency. They thrive and are rewarded for reacting well to changing circumstances. And ultimately, that's Jefferson I wanted to present, was someone who was in the arena dealing with shifting coalitions of opinion, changing circumstances, tumultuous hour at home and abroad. And I thought that Jefferson needed a portrait.
So you take the view that Jefferson's like many of the politicians today who, if you talk to them, you think they agree with you. And, I mean, they're so,
yeah.
But then you find out that that they were agreeable with you, but they did not agree with you.
That's very well put. You know, Eleanor Roosevelt used to warn people when they came out of FDR's presence, saying, just because he said yes, 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 doesn't mean he meant yes, yes, yes. So there's a natural political tendency. It's almost a pastoral tendency. Clergy folk do this a lot, too. You have to take on the scent and the sense of the people you're talking to. And Jefferson was a master at that. And he hated confrontation face-to-face. And so he earned a reputation somewhat overwrought, but entirely undeserved, of being duplicitous. Again, I don't think it was a fundamental character flaw. I think it was just part of the price of doing business as a politician. And he, you know, he was in the midst of building, you know, the first political opposition party in the United States. He was in the midst of trying to articulate an ideal of the American experiment against a ferocious force in Great Britain. He believed that he was operating essentially in a wartime climate most of his life, not just the hot part of the revolution from 76 or so to 82, 83, but really all the way through the War of 1812. He believed that the British were a constant threat to come back, either physically or to exert a fatal influence over the Republican experiment through what he called monarchists.
You made an analogy to the Cold War phobia that we had. I'm trying to put myself in Jefferson's place, and until I read your book, I never really fully appreciated the idea that Americans thought the British were always waiting for the chance to take over again, or retake over again. And
it's an important thing to remember, because, and also it's an easy argument to win, because they did come back. So it's sort of settled. The War of 1812 was a necessary ratifying conflict to make sure that independence would be ensured. And one of the ways I got to this conclusion, I mean, I argue that from the end of the French and Indian War in 1763 until the Treaty of Ghent in 1815 should be seen in part as a 50-year struggle with Great Britain.
Is there evidence? I mean, again, this is a new view of history for me. I'm not a great student, not as great a student of history as I thought I was. Were the British really thinking about taking back over their old colonies, or were they thinking about clearing out this misunderstanding about their dominance of the sea?
Well, both. I mean, it was an odd thing to have lost this coastal republic in the first place. When you think about it, there's a series of military, very close-run military victories. It was humiliating in many ways, and there was a lot of espionage work. There was a lot of subtle attempts to exert influence. There were many powerful people in London who thought the American experiment would be short-lived.
Wow.
And that there would be some kind of, if not a kind of, to use the anachronistic term, not kind of, perhaps a quisling government at some point, or just come on back to the empire. Wow. Again, because there was a second war, it's an argument that makes Jefferson may have been paranoid about the possibilities of this in the 1790s and first decade of the 19th century, but as President Nixon taught us, even paranoids have enemies.
Yeah,
and so it was a real thing. And was Jefferson excessively concerned? George Washington certainly thought so. He kept saying, "There's not above two or three men in America who think what you think," he said once, roughly. And that, again, possibly true, but he believed that there was an insidious and possibly fatal attempt to influence the American government in a way that would make it more of an imperialist pawn of Britain than a standalone republic.
Well,
and the analogy with the Soviet Union and the United States is very imprecise, which I acknowledge. But I think it's worth our thinking about, because otherwise, to some extent, the partisanship, the ferocity of the 1790s doesn't make as much sense if we don't see time as unfolding in the way it did. You know, we turn things into periods. There's a colonial period, then there's an early republic period, then there's the Age of Jackson, then there's the Civil War. That's not the way people live. You know, we don't know that, we don't think of the way, you know, we're not living in the last gasp of the Age of Reagan or the first gasp of the Age of Obama, whatever it is we're in. We don't really think of it that way because we're living our lives. And what the early Americans were doing was that, you know, they did not know how the story was going to turn out. And the British and the French and the Spanish were all forces that with which they had to contend. And it was, as I said, Wellington said of Waterloo, it was a close-run thing.
Well, we're visiting with John Meacham about his new book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is John Meacham. He's the author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. And one of the new, sort of the new focuses on Jefferson is his sense of politics and how Mr. Meacham argues that he's a real politician. There's a great story, John Meacham, in the early part of your book, kind of an epiphany moment where Jefferson, as a young, I guess almost a student, or at least his young lawyer, is observing the House of Burgesses and a vote on he loved Patrick Henry's oratory and saw how Patrick Henry had carried the day on a strong motion regarding relationships with Britain. And then he saw it melt away. That was one of the learning points. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. It was 1765, I want to say, maybe 1766. And Henry is a young man, Louisa County, seen as one of the more radical members of the House of Burgesses. The older leadership, all of whom would become revolutionaries, were not quite as radical at that point. And Henry argued for some quite ferociously worded resolutions denouncing the Stamp Act and imperial authority, and won by a couple of votes on the penultimate day of the session. Then he got on his horse and went
penultimate
back home.
That was supposed to be the last day of the session, or
there was going to be one more day. And Henry left town
after he'd won. He left thinking his victory was secure,
exactly. And Jefferson shows up. He's a student at that point. He shows up reading law with George Wythe. Jefferson shows up next day at the House of Burgesses and finds one of his many cousins, which is just to say he found a person because he was related to everyone in Virginia, going through the rules of the House, trying to find a way to overturn the vote of the previous day. And they found a way. And what he learned there was that you had to master the ways and means of legislative and deliberative bodies. You know, that politics was not simply the grand speech and the emotional moment. It was the nuts and bolts horse trading, to mix metaphors, that always accompanied it. And I think what I think is so interesting about Jefferson, and I throw this out to you and to everybody to try to think of a counterexample. Our greatest presidents throughout our history have been ones who had an unlikely combination of skills. One being able to, in a phrase of FDR's, clarify ideas in the life of the nation, actually being able to articulate a vision of the ideal, of a goal worth seeking, of a future worth sacrificing for, so that present pain was not seen as simply present pain for its sake, but as actual investment. Being able to project that vision. with the skills of a legislative mechanic and actually being able to make this work. And when you think about it, they're not really necessarily compatible, because preachers, philosophers, writers are all very good at painting pictures of where we should go. Actors are brilliant at creating realities we cannot see. And there are many people who are very good at cutting deals. To find the people who can do both has been one of the great geniuses, perhaps inadvertent, of the American electorate. Franklin Roosevelt could do both. Abraham Lincoln could do both. Ronald Reagan could do both. Bill Clinton could do both. We're still to see whether President Obama can. We know President Obama can project, but can he actually, you know, cut the deals that make the ideal come closer to reality, or reality come closer to the ideal? And what Jefferson learned through a long political apprenticeship was how to do both.
Well, it's real interesting, because I was waiting for you to mention John Kennedy or Lyndon Johnson, and you only get it if you sort of make them one person, in the same way that, in the sense that Kennedy could project the ideals and get us all of that, couldn't make a deal, and Johnson had trouble projecting the ideals, but was able to take the ideals of Kennedy and put them into legislation when he became president.
Yeah, I take your point. I disagree.
No, you disagree strongly. don't be.
Oh, no, but it is just a little bit because of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Great example. John Kennedy learning how to cut a deal that saved all of us. I think one of the interesting things about President Kennedy is he offers one of the great examples in American history of being able to watch a president learn on the job. You know, to go from the Bay of Pigs in the first month of his presidency in 61 to the really masterful negotiation and trading, horse trading, trading missiles in Turkey for missiles in Cuba in October of 1962. I don't think the John Kennedy of April 1961 could have done that.
Well,
but the Kennedy of October 1962 could. And I think it's one of the many, many tragedies of Dallas is that he was clearly on a learning curve. And what could he have accomplished if he had been able to continue to have the opportunity to learn and legislate?
Well, no, I love that. There are other aspects of your book that have maybe learning lessons for today, and one of those is the controversy among historians about second terms, about the second term of Jefferson, and that apparently some historians just say he was a total failure. He just, you know, he did nothing. The embargo didn't do anything. He had his eyes on the wrong thing. You're kinder to him on his second term, and I wonder if does that have any do you have any lessons learned for President Obama's second term?
I am kinder about the second term, partly because Henry Adams was so cross about it. One of the things that hurt Jefferson, I think, in the historiography world is if you're going to have someone come after you early, you don't want it to be the grandson and great-grandson of presidents who opposed you and a historian who writes beautifully. So having Henry Adams after you did not help.
Excuse me for jumping in. I just have to confess my ignorance and lack of perception. So, of course, Henry Adams, the historian and writer, is a descendant of John Adams and John Quincy Adams.
Yeah.
And yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. Everybody else knew that, but I mean, everybody knew it, and most people had made the connection and would understand that grandson might be a little bit harder on someone who was their ancestors or parents' rivals. So I apologize for interrupting.
No. And I'm sure there are Adamsites who would virulently object to my slightly overly facile point about Adams. But it is true that there's a kind of arch tone there that I think comes from somewhat genetically transmitted in terms of Adams's monumental books. I mean, they're amazing to read and wonderful. But he, and actually, the other funny thing about Henry Adams's histories of the history of the United States and the administrations of Thomas Jefferson, James Madison is the rather unwieldy title of a masterwork, is that Adams actually appreciates Jefferson for being a really good politician. But there's something about the fact that Jefferson was so much better at it than his forebears and took advantage of that. Remember, the only two one-term presidents until Martin Van Buren were Adams. John Adams lost re-election in 1800, and John Quincy Adams lost it in 1828. I will say this quickly. Tennesseans would argue that John Quincy Adams never won the presidency.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. No, we're
And North Carolinians should appreciate that, given that Andrew Jackson, insofar as he ever studied law, studied it in North Carolina. Yeah. One of my favorite stories about Jackson.
I tell you what, let's take a break, and then I do want to come back and put take advantage of your expertise of both of these presidents and do a little bit of comparison between Jackson and Jefferson. We're visiting with John Meacham about his new book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. And those who know also know the wonderful book about Andrew Jackson. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with John Meacham about his book, Thomas Jefferson and the Art of Power. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about Andrew Jackson, and who was, if you're talking to people in North Carolina, they will promise you he was born in North Carolina. The biographers, there's no unanimity, but the majority opinion is he was born on the South Carolina side of the line. What impact did Jefferson have on Jackson?
Well, Jackson, in many ways, Jefferson and Jackson represent the opposite of many things. Jackson was hot. Jefferson was cool. Jackson was from the lower realms of white society in early America. Jefferson was from the very top. Jackson was virtually uneducated and entirely self-made. Jefferson was beautifully educated and born as the eldest son of a landowning, slave-owning family. So they're very different figures. And so in one of the great ironies of American life, it was the self-made semi-frontiersman, Jackson, of whom a childhood friend remembered wrestling with him and say, the thing about Andy Jackson is you'd throw him, but he'd never stay throwed. this relentless man represented in very rough form the two impulses that Jefferson had also embodied. One was classic Republican, lowercase r theory, that the country should be a republic, a democratic republic, but a republic. And the other, being an expansive view of executive power when you were the one who was the executive. And so Jackson quite explicitly argued that he was a Jeffersonian of the old school and wanted to try to bring the country back, in his view, back to a simpler federal government than the one that John Quincy Adams had been helping create in the 1824 to 28 period. You know, where John Quincy Adams had this wonderful agenda. He was going to a national university and an observatory and internal improvement. I mean, it's a very broad and appealing vision to us. In the politics of the day, however, it was vulnerable to attacks from Jeffersonian, Jacksonian, Democrat, Republicans. At that point, Republicans fully became the Democrats in those confusing party terms of the days. As an overreaching central government. But again, both Jefferson and Jackson were quite happy to overreach when it was their arm doing the reaching. And again, people could say that's hypocrisy. I just think it's the political nature of the American experience. Jefferson believed and articulated a kind of pragmatic philosophy of executive power that both Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt explicitly looked back to in hours of crisis as a kind of guide. Jefferson said, whatever is practicable must control what is pure theory, and what is practicable is largely determined by the habits of the governed. He said that the duty of the chief magistrate is to the strict letter of the law, but that is not the highest duty. The highest duty is, you know, survival of the country, which is how he justified really what he would have thought of in any other man's hands as the unconstitutional purchase of Louisiana. So one of the reasons I do this, one of the reasons I'm so fascinated by these past figures, is I do think that it's important for us now to try to achieve some sense of proportion about the challenges and problems we face. We have overcome existential crises in the past, and I think can continue to do so, although there's no guarantee. And insofar as there's a utility to studying history, studying people in the past, I hope it's two-pronged. One is to look at their moral failings, and not in order to wag our finger at them, or as Arthur Schlesinger used to say, feel self-righteous in retrospect. But if the greatest and most significant figures of the past could live with morally reprehensible institutions, slavery, the removal of Native Americans, if that was such a widely held view as it was in the early Republic, then what are we living with now that is also morally repugnant that the future is going to have to look back on us? So I think the moral utility of history is not to feel better about ourselves, but to be more aware of what we should be doing in our own time. And the other part of it is lowering our blood pressure a little bit, just knowing that great presidents, great leaders are rarely seen as great in their own time. It takes time, it takes distance to understand exactly what someone's legacy is, what we should do. And I think that we would be well served in the country to be slightly more patient with our leaders than we often are.
Well, this is very helpful for us here in Chapel Hill. You can imagine a beautiful campus surrounded with statues of Civil War, Southern soldiers, and buildings named after great leaders of the 19th century, who many of whom were slaveholders or were advocates of the white supremacy movement of the latter part of that century, and students on the campus who have quite different views than those of 100 years ago, understandably wonder why we don't either tear down those statues and rename those buildings, that how can we worship a set of heroes whose views on race are totally incompatible with modern progressive ideas. And you say, first, do what you want to, but put it in the context of the times.
Well, I think that's right. And without getting in the local disputes, I think that you have to make judgments about memorials, about reviving symbolism from the past, based on the totality of circumstance. Mm-hmm. I, for instance, have written a lot through the years about how the Confederate battle flag should simply not be part of the Southern or national culture anymore. Mm-hmm. That it, some people see quote-unquote heritage. I see, and I think a fair-minded historical reading, see defiance to civil rights legislation and Supreme Court decisions in the 1950s and 60s. And so the battle flag should not be part of the panoply of historical symbols, in my view. In a broader sense, the way I try to think about this is, and obviously I had to wrestle with it given Jefferson's slave owning, is less about convicting him, although he does stand convicted before the bar of history, but less about sort of feeling self-superior, and more try to think of what are the issues in our own time that on which a substantial number of voices are making a case for political, moral, economic, cultural reform that a majority of Americans, for reasons of political, moral, economic, and cultural convenience, don't want to heed? Mm. I can think of about six.
Share this with us before we take a break. Yeah, share these with us.
I mean, anyway, well, income inequality. We know that the disparity in wealth in the United States is going to have fundamental political and cultural implications and moral implications. It's simply a fact. How you address it, I don't know, but you have to debate it.
What else?
Climate change is unquestionable to me. I believe that assault weapons in the hands of civilians.
Keep going.
There are a number of issues where people just don't want to do what voices of reform are arguing for because it's inconvenient.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is really meaningful to me. But so that when I argue with my parents or my children argue with me about how we handled race relations in our region during the time that we had the opportunity to change things, and they say, how could you? How could you not? That there will be things that confront our children and their grandchildren down the line, and they say, you know, with how could you live in a society where there were such desperately poor people, where there was a total divide? How did you let it lapse into that? You know, when you think
that is precisely the point I make in almost every talk I give about Jefferson or any president, because any generation, every generation has an enormous failing. There's no question about it. That's the nature of history. What we're given, the gift we're given by being able to have the liberty and the means to study the past, is possibly to raise our own awareness about the existence of such moral quandaries. And not even quandaries. I mean, having X percent of Americans at this hour in hunger or in poverty is a form of madness. I mean, it's not, you know, Jesus said the poor shall be with us always. That's fine, but there don't have to be so many. And I think that there's an important lesson there in terms of generational humility, not becoming, again, to quote Arthur Schlesinger, not becoming self-righteous in retrospect, which, as he put it, is easy, also cheap. You know, there are any number of questions. I have three young children. I am sure that they will be able to point to things in the same way I can point to things in my grandparents' generation in the American South.
Well, you're making me so uncomfortable, John Meacham. I got to take a break.
All right.
We'll come back. We're visiting with John Meacham about his book, Thomas Jefferson and the Art of Power. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. My guest is John Meacham, who's the author of the new book, Thomas Jefferson and the Art of Power, number one New York Times bestseller. And the author has consented to visit with us a little bit. Our friend William Lichtenberg, also a presidential historian of the ages, had hoped to be with us, but a sore back is keeping him away. But he sent a few questions. John Meacham, if you'll, with your permission, I'll ask you.
And I'm a longtime admirer of Professor Lichtenberg, so I'm humbled by them, and I'll probably get them wrong.
I don't think so. Most of these are opinion questions. He says, when historians are polled, they ran only three presidents as great: George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt. Does Jefferson belong there with them?
I think he does, because he built a functional kind of culture of partisanship, in the sense that he and Madison went out when they began to disagree with Washington and Adams and Hamilton in the 1790s and created the means for people who disagreed with the incumbent administration to have a political say in a constructive way. Now, George Washington would disagree that it was constructive, but that's part of the game. I think any president who doubles the size of the country without firing a shot, in many ways, deserves a great deal of credit. And also his insistence on remembering that this had been a revolution about republicanism, about lowercase r republicanism, about making sure that human curiosity and reason and information, education, that those things were absolutely vital to the political life of the country. And I think that he deserves an enormous amount of credit for realizing that citizenship was not simply the person for whom you voted, but it was an all-encompassing way of being.
Well, William Lichtenberg's quite interested in Franklin Roosevelt, and he says that Roosevelt often expressed his admiration for Jefferson and claimed him as a progenitor, but also his fiercest opponents, men who detested centralized government, called themselves Jeffersonian Democrats. Which one of them, asked Dr. Lichtenberg, has the better claim?
As Dr. Lichtenberg knows well, the problem with Winston Churchill also has this problem. The problem with Thomas Jefferson, and having lived so long and written so well about so many different topics, is anyone can quote him on almost anything.
Like the Bible.
Yeah, well, as Shakespeare said, you know, the devil can quote Scripture for his purpose. It's a brilliant question, because in the middle of the, he was seen as, in the middle of the 20th century, Jefferson was seen as a small government, more self-reliance, kind of conservative, as we would now call them. FDR was desperate to conscript both Jackson and Jefferson as the fathers of the New Deal, the spiritual fathers of his way of being. And in fact, FDR was very eager to have the Jefferson Memorial finished in Washington, so that the Democratic Party would have a monument to rival the Republican Lincoln Memorial. Mm. And on the Jackson side, FDR had the inaugural stand in 1937 after that massive landslide where he carried every state but Maine and Vermont. The inaugural stand was a replica of the Hermitage, Andrew Jackson's house in Tennessee. So FDR was very attuned to this symbolism. It's anachronistic, obviously, to try to figure out who had the better claim. My own sense is that based on Jefferson's deeds, not just his words, but what he did as president, is that FDR has the better claim.
We've just got a minute or two more, and I think this is the best question Professor Lichtenberg asked you, and that is, if you were to talk to a group of school children today, what would you tell them they should most bear in mind about Jefferson? That's a tough question.
It's a fabulous question. It's that Thomas Jefferson represents the best of us and the worst of us. No one ever articulated the promise of the country more brilliantly, and no one ever in that generation showed us how far we could fall short of fulfilling that promise in our own lives. And it's an eternal reminder that even the greatest among us have failings, faults, sins, but that it is not enough, it is not right to consign people who are imperfect to some corner of the historical classroom, because we're all imperfect. And the magic of democracy, the point of statecraft, is when imperfect people manage to make things just a little better. And Jefferson left the world a better place than he found it, even though he was a deeply flawed and deeply imperfect human being.
Well, John Meacham, thank you very much. I wish we had more time. Dr. Lichtenberg, had several more really great questions, and I had a lot of things that I would love to talk to you about, but this has just been wonderful. Thanks for your great book, and many, many thanks for taking time to visit with us here in Chapel Hill.
Absolutely delighted. Thank you.
And thanks to each of you for listening. This has been D.G. Martin. It's been Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.